Thank you for tuning in to this podcast. This is brought to you by Technocracy.news. I'm Patrick Wood, your host. Please check out all the latest news and trends and events on technocracy from around the world at Technocracy.news, and also take time to check out my book, Technocracy Rising, the Trojan Horse of Global Transformation. And now, our interview for today.
Welcome back to the Technocracy News Hour. We're talking today with Mr. Carl Tykrib from Canada. He's a researcher, a writer, an author. He's a frequent speaker at conferences, and he's an expert on things relating to the United Nations, to globalization, to religious globalization, and other things. I am Patrick Wood, your host for this hour, and Carl, thank you for coming on today and sharing your knowledge with us.
My friend, it's good to be on your podcast. Thank you for inviting me.
Indeed, and we agreed already that we wanted to talk today about the religious aspects of globalization today, and the context of this within the United Nations, the context of the United Nations, that is, we have the movement towards sustainable development. We have essentially war having been declared on capitalism and free enterprise. The United Nations has been very clear that it intends to replace capitalism and free enterprise with their so-called green economy or sustainable development. And then we have we notice a distinctly religious flavor about not only sustainable development, but climate change, global warming, stuff like that. And nobody's talking about this, Carl. I my feeling is that you have something to contribute to us on this. And I want to know, my listeners want to know too, what's this religious stuff going on at the United Nations and why should we care? You want to take a shot at that?
Oh, absolutely, Pat. You know, I'm glad you brought in the religious aspect because you're right. It seems to be underreported. And part of the reason that I believe that that's happening is because people believe that, oh, this is just religion. And religion doesn't necessarily have a lot of bearing on what the secular world is doing and what the world of politics is engaging in. I would contend that that's the wrong approach. And I'll tell you why. Back in 2010, and I've seen this going all the way back, back before the turn of the millennium, in the late 1990s, but in 2010 in particular, I had the opportunity of going to the G8, G20 World Religions Summit, which took place in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada. And the World Religions Summit was a parallel to the G8 political meeting, which was happening in Ontario at the time. And of course, as many of your listeners will know, when the G8 gets together, all the cameras are on the political action, and there's rioting and all kinds of things happening, and it's a big deal. But what most people don't realize is that at the same time, for a number of years already, there has been an interfaith religious component that goes along with it. And I attended that event, which got no coverage. And yet, what was interesting, Pat, was the acknowledgement that by the very fact that the religions were coming together, we, I'm going to put myself here in first person because I was there, we represent a larger constituency than many political, governmental environments. We have more people, let's say, under the Church of England or under the Catholic Church or who follow various strands of Hinduism or Islam than sometimes even the populations of whole countries. And so it was recognized that while the political players had tremendous clout and tremendous influence, the religious leadership of the world probably exhibits as much, if not more, but it's a quiet, soft kind of political power. And now if we could just rally up those incredible masses of people behind the religious leadership calling for things like at the G8 World Religion Summit, world taxation, calling for harsher methods of dealing with climate change. The list went on and on. We were talking about politics, Pat. Totally talking about politics and economics, but doing it from the perspective of religious constituencies.
Is this, Carl, coming to us from a coordinated effort to co-opt the churches into supporting the globalization process, or is this just happening?
Oh, no. There is some coordinated processes behind it. There definitely is enough momentum already where church groups and religious organizations are already beginning to do these things themselves, birth their own little conferences and meetings and working groups. But with that particular event, it was coordinated, and it was coordinated through the Canadian Council of Churches, and particularly it was coordinated through three or four main individuals who are members of the World Federalist Community, the World Federalist Movement, which is the largest pro-world government lobby group on the planet. And they were the ones who are directly in charge of at least the event I attended in Winnipeg. And so there was this direct connection, an inescapable connection between politics and religion at the global level. Literally, global governance with religious backing 100% of the way.
You know, 2 years ago, or a year and a half ago, the World Council of Churches talked about green faith. And how, at one of the big conference they had interfaith conference, on how all these different religious groups got together and committed themselves to green faith. What the heck is green faith, Carl?
It's the idea that our loyalty now lies to our allegiance to the earth. It is the concept here that the earth is our mother, and this is where we now have to put our energy, our purpose, our meaning. You know, postmodernism is interesting. I'm just going to jump off on a quick rabbit trail here, but it's important. Postmodernism, understanding that is important, because postmodernism, for the last 40, 50 years, and that's what we've in the West have been, the intellectual thinking has been, which basically says your truth is your truth, my truth is my truth. There's no authority. There's no real purpose. There's no real meaning. It's a search for new standards of truth, a rejection of the old standards. And ultimately, when it boils right down, if you just bring it right down to the most essence, the most important aspect of it, it's about asking questions and never really finding answers. Well, you know, Pat, we have entered a different age. We're no longer really living in that postmodern question mark. We now have the answer. And I saw that answer when I was at the Global Citizenship 2000 Youth Congress, which was all about rearranging our educational priorities back in 1997 to become global citizens. And the rearrangement of our priorities is this. We now know the answers. We now know the meaning. We now know our purpose. And that is, it is about our allegiance and our loyalty to the planet, to our mother, to the goddess. It goes back to the concept of re-enchantment. It's an ancient future worldview, one that pulls from ancient pagan past. And through technology and the sciences and through our political developments today, we can reanimate that purpose and now have new life and new meaning for humanity. And that life and meaning is found in our dedication to the planet.
Is this really a resurgence of paganism and some of the ancient occultic religions that existed thousands of years ago?
I think to some extent it is. I'll tell you why. In October of 2015, I went to the Parliament of World Religions in Salt Lake City, and about 10,000 religious leaders and activists came. It was a huge event, and it was directly tied also to the politics of climate change. There were working sessions on how religious communities could now impact and influence the Paris conference that would be taking place a few weeks later. I went to a working session on the Earth Charter and how that was being used as a type of global ethic. But what really struck me, Pat, was the open, acknowledged recognition that paganism, the old classical forms of paganism, were being rebirthed and reanimated for a new era. And so we had, let's say, I'll just give you an example. We had a women's plenary event, and we also had a women's inaugural parliament, a special day just for women's issues. And so at the plenary, it started off with a song, and I'm not going to sing because I'm a lousy singer, but the song went like this. And there was a person in the front of the auditorium, and there was thousands of people. I mean, packed thousands of people, mostly women, in the women's plenary. And she started off by singing, "Goddess, Mother, Shakti of this earth." and thousands of women in unison sang back to her, "Goddess, Mother, Shakti of this earth." And the entire event was built around the sense that you are a divine priestess. Mother Earth is waking up. Mother Earth is you. You are the goddess. The goddess is coming. This type of flavoring, and I mean, it was so palpable, so powerful, that when Marianne Williamson was done her keynote address, where she told us that we were all divine priestesses, the response from the crowd wasn't just clapping or a standing ovation. It was cheering, it was stomping, it was yelling, it was, people beside me were crying, they were bawling, drums were going off. It was like a worship service, an unbelievable, emotionally driven worship service, recognizing that the goddess is now active and that we are taking the goddess into politics, into culture, and into society.
Wow, this is pretty radical.
It was. Hey, I'll tell you a little bit more, a couple other spots for the Parliament of World Religions. The goddess was so represented there that we had a hallway to the goddess. And I counted 89 mural depictions of the goddess down one of the main hallways. I went to numerous working sessions on resurrecting the goddess, bringing the goddess back. Pagan workshops. One pagan workshop, which was really interesting, was pagan response to Pope Francis's encyclical on the environment. And during that workshop, sections of Pope Francis's encyclical were read. Another section of a pagan document on sustainability was read, and the question was asked, can you tell who wrote what? No, it sounded the same. It had the same sense of purpose back to the earth, back to the planet, back to this loyalty to our mother.
Are there any particular evidences or icons at the United Nations that would tie into this type of ancient religion?
There is the spiritual prayer room that's dedicated at the United Nations, and I've been there when I was at the United Nations for the Millennium Forum back in the year 2000. I spent a little bit of time at that room just poking around and checking it out, and it definitely is a place where you can go to express your spirituality, however pat you want that to be. And when I was there, we did have talk about having our perspectives turned back towards the earth, the whole aspect of a planetary allegiance and loyalty. That I saw and experienced firsthand through the event. But you know something, and this is why it's important for us to actually watch and monitor what's taking place at the United Nations. Here's an example. You all know about Agenda 21. You're an expert in Agenda 21. There's a lot of people who have done some great homework on Agenda 21. There's some things that happened at the Rio Earth Summit in 1992 that definitely brings about a paganistic aspect to it. For an example, there was the NGO working group, the NGO forum that took place during the conference itself, and there was a non-stop sacred fire that was lit. It was a place where you could come and express yourself regarding Mother Earth. It was a very vocally, powerfully religious example of the NGO community coming together and integrating religion and politics. But at the end of the Rio Earth Summit, at the closing hours of the event, United Nations Secretary General Boutros Ghali said these words, and this encapsulated what happened at the Rio Earth Summit. He said this, "I should like to conclude by saying that the spirit of Rio must create a new form of good citizenship. After loving his neighbor as the Bible required him to, post-Rio man must also love the world, including the flowers, birds, and trees, every part of that natural environment that we are constantly destroying. Over and above the moral contract with God, over and above the social contract concluded with men, we must now conclude an ethical and political contract with nature, with this earth to which we owe our very existence and which gives us life." Now, Pat, here's the rest of it, and this is really important. "To the ancients, the Nile was a god to be venerated, as was the Rhine, an infinite source of European myths, or the Amazonian forest, the mother of forests. Throughout the world, nature was the abode of the divinities that gave the forest, the desert, or the mountains a personality which commanded worship and respect. The earth had a soul. To find that soul again, to give it new life, that is the essence of Rio, unquote.
And we know the people who were behind Rio.
Right.
For right. Sure. In general, not only your favorite Canadian who's recently passed away.
Right.
But also people like Stephen Rockefeller were there promoting those types of things.
Absolutely. And so this is that intersection between politics and religion, because what I just read to you is very religious. In fact, that last section is classical paganism.
Indeed. Indeed. Well, where is this taking the world? We have the Christian tradition churches, if you will, and then you have the New Age / pagan oriented churches. And they all seem to be going in the same direction.
Right, right.
Is there a merger down the road? Is there something like a merger going to take place here, do you think? Because they're both beginning to pursue identical ideologies about worshiping the earth.
Right. I don't necessarily see this as being, let's say, an official merger. It's an emerger. It's an emergence of, let's say, a common consciousness.
Exactly.
Where all of them are agreeing, even though they don't necessarily hold hands as an organization, or they don't hold hands politically, but there is definitely a similarity of consciousness, a shift in the way that they think. Part of this, Pat, goes back to the first Earth Day, April the 22nd, 1970. And there was a book that came out called The Environmental Handbook. This environmental handbook was given to high school students, college students, and it was used as the text, the first real text for the environmental movement that could be put in the hands of school people, educators, school children, this type of thing. And what's interesting, as you go through that book, in the very first few pages, in fact, the first real essay or chapter of the book, it describes the environmental crisis as landing in the laps of us as Christians. We're the one to blame. Christianity is the one to blame. And it takes Lynn White's famous essay on the history of the ecological crisis, and it reprints that essay in there, which says, Christianity, you're the ones who are at fault. In fact, the world is not going to see a renewed sense of ecology until we find a new religion to replace the old one. And then towards the end of the book, he actually gives a list of various religions that are acceptable, including witch doctors and shamans and mystical Catholicism through the teachings of Teilhard de Chardin. There's a whole list of earth-based religions that they say, this is the acceptable way to go. But what's interesting is what happened with the church community, the Christian community, at that first Earth Day. Instead of us asking the question, are we really at fault? Instead of us saying, or probing the accusation and really thinking about it and then responding to it with truth, instead what we did, Pat, is we waved the white flag and said, oh, we've always been the good guys. We've always viewed ourselves as the good guys. Now all of a sudden we realize we're really the bad guys. We too need to change. We too need to embrace the earth the way the world is telling us to. And so instead of actually confronting the accusation and doing so in a way that was powerful and truthful, we capitulated. And that's what we've been doing ever since.
Yeah, I wonder, what do you think the difference would have made had the truly evangelical Christian church have raised some warnings on this early on? Do you think that would have made a difference, or?
I think it definitely would have stalled some of it. It may not have made a difference in the overall scheme, but at the very least, it would have created some tension. It would have created conflict and some clash, because what you're looking at here is an ideological struggle. But at the very least, it would have shut up a certain percentage of the liberal progressive voices that at that point in time were really poking at Christianity. Hey, you know, when we capitulated like that, we more or less allowed that narrative, this narrative of the earth as being our mother, this narrative that the earth is where we our loyalties and allegiances lies, we allowed that narrative to become the dominant narrative.
Exactly. You know, the whole thing boils down to a conflict with the book of Genesis, where when the earth was created, when man was created, placed on the earth, man was the pinnacle of God's creation, clearly. And the earth was given to man with instructions to take dominion over the land, over the earth, for his maintenance and sustenance and enjoyment.
Right.
And this has been turned upside down completely, and to the point where man should rather serve the earth. In other words, the earth may well take dominion over man, and man is not the pinnacle of creation, but rather a product of the earth. And this is just diametrically opposed to the biblical narrative, for sure. We see this concept or this thought all the way through all of these various religions, that man is to serve the earth, not the other way around.
That's right.
So God set it in place originally that the earth would be controlled and would be would serve the needs of man. And now it's just exactly the opposite. This is an ancient conflict between not just good and evil, but between God and Satan.
It is. The conflict extends into the sense that either reality is God, distinct, separate, unique, utterly different than creation. In other words, the reality is built around the concept of two, God and everything else. Or God, man, and nature are intrinsically one. They're all connected. They're interdependent. It's a holistic system. It's wheels within wheels. And you cannot really find a point of separation. And that's what we're seeing today. That's the narrative that's coming into our culture, that God, man, and nature are essentially all one. That is the classic aspect of paganism. And when you take a look at what that looks like then politically, because it also has a political face. In fact, it has an economic face. It has a cultural face. Because if that is a dominant worldview, you will see that intersecting in so many areas. And so the political face of that is a sense of global governance, because we all now have to become one. We're becoming one in political function and political purpose. And of course, the purpose is aiming back at the earth, which ultimately aims back to us, because we're all now gods and goddesses. In fact, I was told that at the Parliament of World Religions, you are all Mother Earth walking. And so you cannot divorce the political ramifications of that religious worldview, whereas the biblical worldview, which says God is distinct and other, therefore means that as creatures of his, we look to him as the one who gives us guidance and nourishment, and the one who we place our faith and our purpose and our trust in.
Right. You know, it's ironic in America especially. I don't know how it is in Canada, but in America, we have a big conflict going on for some time about separation of church and state. We have the ACLU running around suing anybody that they think they can sue and get away with, intimidation tactics to do everything from taking the Ten Commandments off of a courthouse wall to removing nativities from in front of any public buildings or elsewhere if they can pull it off. And this separation of church and state, which is kind of a bogus argument anyway, but aside from that, it's basically to drive Christianity out of the public forum. And they've done a very good job. Mm-hmm. But this was all done in on the basis that, well, the government can't force a religion down your throat. That's kind of the concept behind it. It's not right for the government to force some religion, state religion, down your throat. So we can't sponsor any religion like Christianity especially. However, with the introduction of all of the sustainable development / Agenda 21 / 2030 Agenda / ad infinitum, this being impressed by our administration all over America, are they? Do you think that in fact that a de facto state religion has been established and is in fact being crammed down our throat?
Oh, I think so. We have a state religion, and the state becomes the cathedral. Our governments and halls of power become the cathedrals of this new religion. It becomes a point where the religion becomes activated, and it becomes activated through policies and through regulations and through bureaucracies, as it forces us now, whether they realize it or not, because this is how embedded that mindset has become. It forces them to pursue this goal in a religious-like fashion. It has a religious fervor. It makes the claim that it is the only truth, which is why you now, even within the climate community, and in terms of climate skepticism and climate alarmists, the climate alarmists are always saying, "Well, we have the truth. We have the only truth," because We've got our reports. We've got our climate change conferences, and anybody that dares question this narrative, you're dangerous. You're separating. You're against the accepted norm. It is interesting. We are looking at truth claims, and they're conflicting truth claims, because as this narrative, this new religion says, we have a truth claim. The biblical view also is we have a truth claim. And the truth claim held from the biblical position is that, man is not God. Nature is not God. Politics isn't the cathedral of religion. Anytime that man takes on the action of becoming as a God, the only thing we can do is kill. We are really lousy at that, at creating life out of nothing. We've never been able to do it. But we have done a great job of being able to take life. It says, the biblical view basically says, no, you're not God. There is an exclusive truth claim. Jesus Christ said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. That's an exclusive truth claim. But it runs counter to the truth claim given by the proponents of this new global religion. They're both truth claims, but only one of them truly can be true, obviously, because they're in conflict and in contradiction.
They are. And you have people like Al Gore, of course, the poster child for global warming, globally, recently said that climate deniers, that is people who don't believe like him on climate change issues, global warming in particular, that climate change deniers should be punished. And he used that word, punished. And we've seen this theme, this meme, come up in other writings now, where one side is trying to punish the other side for not believing the way it believes. Now, this was the kind of thinking that started the Inquisition once upon a time.
Right, that's exactly it. I was just going to say, that's the Inquisition. We have a new religious priesthood of politics and science, and we have a new Inquisition, or at the release, we're on the edge of that concept of a new Inquisition. And it may look differently than the old Inquisition, obviously, but the same religious fervor is there.
Well, yeah, still, of course, Al Gore didn't say what punish means, which I'm glad he didn't go that far. But we've seen, since then, we've seen some intimation on what it means to be punished, and basically it's exclusion from society. In other words, you can't play in our game at all if you are going to not go along with our belief system. Right. And even though their belief system is not carefully spelled out in religious terms, we see the religious backing behind this, and we realize, they're talking in spiritual concepts, but they're using secular language.
Exactly. Yes. Can I give you an illustration of that, of the concept of an Inquisition taken from the Rio Earth Summit Conference? It's interesting, Pat. I have in my hands a copy of a document. It was not 1992. This is a 1990 document. It was a Government of Manitoba report that came out through a conference held in Winnipeg, and it was one of the preparation conferences to the Real Earth Summit. What a lot of people don't realize is that all of these major United Nations events have preparatory conferences and other events leading up to the main one. And it's these background events where they flesh out at sometimes a very, very brazen level what they would ultimately like to see happen at the big event down the road. Well, that's what this was in 1990, October 17th to the 20th. The event was known as the World Environment, Energy, and Economic Conference. And its theme, its official theme, was Sustainable Development Strategies and the New World Order. I kid you not. And so their document that was put out, and again, this is a government document, a provincial government document. About 3,000 world religious, world leaders came, including, I believe, some from religions, but mostly from the political side, including Marie Strong, who, as you know, was the Secretary General for the Real Earth Conference in 92. In this document, that's a lot of lead up to it, I realize, but in this document, in Chapter 2, entitled Toward a Global Green Constitution, it says this. Again, this is the idea of that inquisition. The issues are not about if a global politics is necessary. The question is, how do we achieve binding agreements in law, complete with effective programs for applying sanctions against non-compliance that would oblige each nation, regardless of size, to abide by a set of principles that are required to guarantee the survival of life on this earth? That's a mouthful, I realize, but it goes on. Perhaps we will find that there is no other alternative to a system of rigid controls that some would equate to a police state. Unfortunately, in order to save the planet from biocide, there have to be very powerful constraints from doing the wrong things. The constraints must transcend national boundaries, be world around, and enforceable. There would be a need for an agency for preventing eco-vandals from acting unilaterally. Enforcement agencies would need the power to act without being invited by the offending nation. Therefore, there needs to be an agency that is acceptable to all nation states on the planet. We can probably accept the fact that there will always be one or more nations that will not go along, but there must be effective sanctions in place. If sanctions do not work, then physical occupation and the installation of a world trusteeship would be imposed upon the offending nations. Yikes! That's not the world I want to be a part of. Not at all.
For sure.
But that's language that says what we need is a world authority, and we will have inquisitions against anybody that opposes the world authority. And that particular chapter makes it very clear that this is about Mother Earth and Gaia, and referencing the Gaia hypothesis directly, that we are moving towards this concept of one world. And here's a political, powerful political expression of that. Now, obviously, this didn't come to pass, but it gives you a sense of that flavoring that was already undergirding some of the thinking behind the Real Earth Summit and Agenda 21, because this was a preparatory conference to it.
That's really profound. And we could skip back in history a little bit, even back to the 17th, 18th century, and look at some of the philosophical underpinnings of that might have led up to some of the stuff. And we see, at least I see, in terms of the United Nations and what they're doing with all these different programs, science has entered into religion in a major way. It seems like it's given justification for many of the conclusions that these people are putting forward. Like if they couldn't justify it in metaphysical terms, now they can justify it in scientific terms, even if it's pseudoscience, it's still, they consider it to be science. And back somewhere around 1800, a French philosopher, Henri de Saint-Simon, he wrote about scientism. And he said, "A scientist, my dear friends, is a man who foresees. It is because science provides the means to predict that it is useful, and the scientists are superior to all other men. And Saint Simon went on to disciple many people, including Auguste Comte, who together promoted a priesthood, if you will, a scientist, to administer to society. And we kind of see a model of this merging today with this, you know, it's just outright religious movement, paganism, pantheism, under whatever name you put it, green faith. You see this priesthood has been established, and you know the parishioners, the people of the world, are just absolutely being forced to do whatever science says. That's a very convenient type of a dictatorship, isn't it? Where you can make science say whatever you want, and then now you have to go do that. But science hasn't necessarily said anything, but nevertheless, you have to go do that, or else, like as Al Gore says, we'll punish you.
I know. We really are entering a new religious era, and it's a religious era that combines the secular, the pagan, and why does this look so appealing? And why does this look so profoundly tantalizing to the world that we're living in? Because ultimately, this goes back to Genesis 3. We are taking control of our own future and our own destiny. We are turning our back on God, just like we did in Genesis 3. It's the same lie, the same deception that we see back in the garden, where God says to Adam and Adam and Eve, "Do not eat of the fruit." They do, and in so doing, they believe that they can become as God or become godlike through special knowledge. They have now been, their eyes have been opened. They have been enlightened, and the result of that obviously was death. Why was death the result? There's a logical conclusion to turning our backs against the author of life. When you turn your back against the one who created you, literally the author of life, the logical conclusion is death. And so what we've been doing ever since that time, Pat, is we've been repackaging the same thing. We've been repackaging that same belief that we can become through science, through our enlightenment, through our arts, through our culture, through our politics, through our religion, through our technology, we can become as God. And we can chart our own course in our own direction. And the end result of all of this always ends up in our demise. That's why we have things like even Bertrand Russell. Bertrand Russell, who was a famous British philosopher from the last century, in his book, The Future of Science, says this: "I believe that, owing to man's folly, a world government will only be established by force, and will therefore be at first cruel and despotic. But I believe that is necessary for the preservation of a scientific civilization, and that, if once realized, it will gradually give rise to other conditions of a tolerable existence." I mean, he's telling you right out, we need to have world government, it's going to be cruel, it's going to be tyrannical, but that's exactly what we need to ensure a scientific civilization. And then, once a scientific civilization is in place, then maybe it can come around and become a little bit more cute and cuddly, but for the longest time, we have to have fangs on this beast.
It wouldn't be too much of a jump from where we are right now in our conversation to maybe go over and touch on transhumanism just a bit. And let me preface this way. We have a political party in America called the Transhumanist Party. This is new. This will be new to a lot of people, but you can go and look them up. It's called, on the web, it's called transhumanparty.org. And it's a legitimate registered political party in America, and they are running a man for president. They have a presidential candidate. His name is Zoltán István. And he is promoting transhumanism as the answer to the political future. This is quite amazing. He's got a tour going where he's taken a motorhome. And he's converted the outside of the motorhome into a hearse. Not a hearse, a casket. actually has flowers on top too, but it looks like a giant casket floating down the freeway. And he's stumping around America talking about using science to promote transhumanism to escape death. He's basically saying that you too can be immortal if you, you know, follow me and my transhuman party. We will conquer through science. We will conquer death, and we'll all live happily ever after. Now, this guy is no joke. I mean, people laugh at this at first and say, "Oh, that's the funniest thing I ever heard." Well, you could read about him on Wired magazine. You can read about him in the Financial Times, the Huffington Post, the Daily Mail, the Telegraph, Business Insider, Esquire, BuzzFeed, Popular Science, Reason Magazine. He's published articles or had articles published in all these different places. He's a graduate of Columbia University yet. And he's going wild, running around promoting transhumanism as the wave of the future, and he's trying to popularize the whole concept. Now, this has gone beyond just a parlor topic, you know, where we just kind of talk about what the crazy people are doing out there, I guess. This has gone mainstream.
Right. You know, and I know Zoltan has, even has some critics within the transhumanist community, actually quite a few critics because of the approach that Zoltan takes. I mean, driving around with a coffin bus, to me, is not exactly a way of winning votes. The symbolism and the message of the symbol says is vote for me and you will die. That's, you know, kind of like, why would you vote for this? Let me go back. I had a chance to attend a transhumanist event in December. It was in Second Life, a virtual conference in a virtual world, and of course, virtual reality in Second Life, and Second Life is one of the more dominant virtual worlds out there, is viewed as one of those milestones towards achieving transhumanism. And Zoltan was one of the speakers at this transhumanist conference. And Zoltan, as an atheist, because that's what he is, made some interesting points. He conceded that maybe there is a type of spirituality that we should be pursuing, and there is maybe a sense of something bigger than ourselves, a spiritual component. And he had told us that he had been spending time with some of the people from TerraSem, which is a trans religion built around transhumanism, and conceded to us that maybe we can form some type of resurrection through technology, and that maybe even the Christian eschatology, the ideas of revelation, we can maybe pursue and see this developing through our science and our technology. Maybe we can resurrect ourselves. We can create our own heaven on earth. And on he went. But what he was saying was interesting for myself, because I've intersected a lot with the transhumanist community. And for the longest time, it was mostly a secularist, atheist pursuit. Now, it really has more of a spiritual component to it. It's a recognition that this is turning into a type of religion, that this is beyond just simply a secular movement. In fact, there's a number of religious personalities who are embracing transhumanism. When I was at the Parliament of World Religions in Salt Lake City, one of the workshops I went to was on the Divine Mother and how the Divine Mother was going to expand herself in this new planetary age. And on at least two occasions, one of the panelists talked about this as being entering into our transhuman period, our transhuman era, as we recognize now that we have this sense of loyalty back to the mother. And I'm like, that was an interesting word to use, because transhumanism is a technology-driven, science-driven a way of thinking. And now to bridge this into something else, I found quite fascinating, because here we're seeing this interconnection between these various ideas that sometimes look to be at odds with each other. But if you boil it right down, whether it's pagan ideas of the goddess or whether it's transhumanist ideas that man can ascend and become godlike, it really says this, that man, God, and nature, we're all one, And that's what we are trying to prove, and trying to prove so, so desperately.
So there's kind of a common thread that run through various religions, maybe even including atheism,
right?
That speaks to something outside the understanding of man that we need to achieve, at least to attempt to achieve. So I think we talked once upon a time about the hidden keys within various religions that seem to be opened by a key now different locks that are opened by a key now that is common to all. So we have this, all of a sudden we have commonalities found between Buddhism and Hinduism, for instance, and even aberrant types of Christian teachings that are floating around. And paganism, and some of the occultic religions from the old days, and some of the more modern theosophies, and different cults and stuff, that they seem to have built into them some desire to conquer immortality.
Right. Right, and you know, this seems to be that theme that goes all through human history. You see this popping up over and over again. But today we are looking at the works of our hands, our science and our technology, as being one of those ways to achieve this ancient dream that we've had. That's why this new era that we're entering, which some call re-enchantment, this idea that we are now finding a new spiritual purpose, we are finding a new sense of meaning. That's why this is really an ancient future worldview, because we're pulling from the ancient past, those ancient wisdoms, and we're marrying it, we're combining it with the technology and the science that we've developed, which, you know, I'm thankful for. We're using science and technology right now. This interview is being done by Skype. And we're talking, even though we're on two totally different sides of the continent. But we're marrying all of this to prove that we don't necessarily need this God who's outside of creation. We're in charge of our own destiny. And that's always been the heartbeat of whether it's myself individually or you or anybody else individually. We've always struggled with that, and always... society has always been moved by that. And so what we're seeing happening is collectively that same rebellion that's in our individual hearts is now just simply being acted out at a collective societal level. And of course, that has much bigger ramifications for people and for groups than just simply my own sense of hubristic pride. But it's this pride we have in humanity. It's this pride that we have within ourselves, that through our own works, through our own science, our technology, our rituals, our religions, whatever it may be, we will be enlightened and we will be as gods.
So I remember back in the 1970s and 80s that all of these discussions were basically metaphysical. There was there was no substance to it necessarily. It's just people talking about ideas and belief systems and so on. And there were just so many different groups back then that were discussing various aspects of these things. But I'm impressed by the thought that they were all pretty much just kind of metaphysical discussions at that point. They didn't have anything to hang their hat on other than what they had in their head. But right. When science entered a picture, and when science really began to advance and assert itself, these various groups had substance all of a sudden to hold out, not as a carrot, but just to hold out as proof, say, see, we told you we were right. And now we have the means to achieve these things. And not only that, we're going to achieve these things. And of course, they, you know, nobody can predict the future, of course, but they make a good stab at it that they're going to achieve all these things. But they haven't achieved very much yet, have they, really?
No, they haven't. They haven't, at least in terms of, at least in terms of something that's tangible that we can see. But what they have achieved, though, is they have achieved the fact that society has changed its mind, that we've entered a new worldview. They've definitely done a very good job at that. And so those metaphysical ideas that were bounced around and then the concepts of science that came alongside of it to all of a sudden offer that the direction that they needed. James Lovelock and his Gaia hypothesis was a great example of where all of a sudden science and metaphysics came together, and all of a sudden, poof, we have a new scientific theory that the Earth is alive and that the Earth is an organism, and that now we owe our allegiance to this organism because we don't want to kill her. That became all of a sudden a dominant scientific theory or hypothesis, which is really the best way of looking at it. And all of a sudden now, those metaphysical concepts that we as the Christian community laughed at and thought, oh, you guys are just crazy, this is a fad, you know, 50, 40 years ago, I'm sorry, it's now the worldview of your children and your grandchildren, and they believe it, and they've built a sense of reality around this, and their science and their technology, which links them all together now in ways that was unheard of even 15, 20 years ago, demonstrates that we are all interconnected, and see, here's the proof, we're all becoming one.
Indeed, indeed. Carl, I wish we had time to just spend hours talking about this, because I think we could.
Oh, yeah.
There's so much to it, and there's so many different splinters of it as well that are all related, but they're different, just kind of different slices of the whole pie.
Right.
But clearly, one thing we can say before we end, just to kind of give the overarching thing on this, the whole move towards globalization and the implementation of technocracy and the implementation of a scientific dictatorship, if you will, via scientism, all of this stuff has been spilled over into the spiritual / religious community as well. It's been blended together. It's been one's propped up to support the other. And this is an important meme, I think, that people really need to get a handle on.
I agree, Pat. And in fact, unless we get a handle on this, a lot of other things won't necessarily make sense. And I think it's also important so that we ourselves, especially as Christians, watch our own denominations, our own church groups fall into some of these memes. I think it's important for us to understand so that we can put the brakes on and say, hold on, let's talk about this. You're going down a road that we really need to change direction with. I'm going to leave you with a quote, and I think it's an important quote from Jacques Ellul. Earlier on, you quoted a French philosopher from the 19th century. Here's one from last century, a French philosopher who is an interesting thinker. He says this: secularization is always an intermediate stage between a religious society on the way out and the appearance of a new religious structuring. I think he's right.
Oops, I think he is. I think so. Well, Carl, I thank you so much for your time, my friend, and I hope we can pursue this and other topics. Gosh, we never really talked too much about technocracy. We could have developed transhumanism so much more. It's all important, but to get a whole rounded, can I use the word holistic, understanding of
yes.
What's going on in the world? You need to study this stuff, folks. You need to pay attention to it. And if you don't, it's going to come back to bite you and people you love. So don't be passive about this. Be active and learn what's going on, and then learn to give an answer for the hope that you have within you, which, of course, would be a relationship with the God of the universe, in fact, that is the Lord Jesus Christ. So for whatever that's worth, wherever this podcast finds you, I hope you find it useful, and I hope you continue to follow the works of technocracy.news and myself, Patrick Wood, and, of course, my friend Carl Teichrib, who's a researcher and writer extraordinaire from Canada. You can find his works. Just go to the internet and search for Teichrib. That's a unique name. Not too many Teichribs running around. It's T-E-I-C-H-R-I-B. And you will find more stuff that will just blow your mind than you've seen in a long time. So, Carl Teichrib, thank you, sir, for being on. We will touch base again in the future on the Technocracy News Hour.